session number 11268, room 5.
It's Joseph Clement, Reel 5. We're talking about a sort of what would happen during a typical day, and just running through various topics. Yes. You know, mainly during the summer in the front line at Helles. Did you have to actually fire your machine gun much? I mean, that's what you were, a machine gunner.
Yes. If you were always trained on a certain spot, you knew there was if you'd see an intersection of the. Where the Turks' communication trench came down during the front line. Usually they had it covered overhead, but they've got to get to that first each way. And we'd get lined up on that, you see, and then every so often we'd give them a burst there. We may not hit them, we made them keep their head down at any rate. And of course, no doubt they'd done the same to us in our place.
At one point you were firing on Krithia, I think, using a telescope. Could you tell me about that?
Oh, yes. Well, where the telescope came from, I don't know. And Krithia was pretty well the extent of their range of our gun. So my number two and I, we used to take it in turns. We'd train on Krithia, which was perhaps 1,200 yards or perhaps more. And there was a street running in our favour, up and down. We're looking at it. And a mill train used to come down there with supplies and things like that, you see. So I'd be looking through this telescope and say, "Jock, get ready. They're on the way." And then when they came into view, I'd let go, seeing he'd put a burst of there, about 25 rounds perhaps. See, you could see some of the mules kicking their heels up in the air and scattering there. I don't know if they were actually killed or anything like that, because it was the extent of the range of the gun, the effective range of it. It scared them up at any rate. And so then it was my turn next time.
Who would decide when you could and couldn't fire your machine gun? Were you under any control from an officer or NCO?
No. Sometimes you'd be told, don't fire it any more than necessary. If you see any movement, yes, fire. But not just for the sake of firing. Until you think you can hit something or do something, fire then. But not just for the sake of it.
Would you know, why would they tell you to do that? Why would they tell you to do that? Was there any reason?
I don't know about that.
Was there any ammunition shortage you were aware of?
Well, not that I'm aware of. We always seem to have plenty. But, of course, there could have been. There was quite a few more than us there.
Did you always carry on with the same gun, or did you get to shoot
with... Oh, yes.
So it's still a Maxim you had, wasn't it?
Yes.
So, now, was there much Turkish machine gun fire?
Oh, yes, they're pretty busy with theirs, yeah.
The same sort of thing as you did?
Same, yes, pretty well the same. When we place, say the only name of one place that I remember is Munster Terrace. Now that may have been where the Munster Fusiliers were at one time. I take it it was.
What do you remember about that place?
Well, it was on a little rise of the ground, and the Turkish trench was down a gradual slope away from the top of this little ridge. We put our gun up there. And we could see quite a bit of movement down in the gully. Might have been about 200 or 300 yards away. And we had a good view of anything, more or less anything that moved just above ground sort of business. We used to let fly with that. That was the only actual place of that I knew the name of any one particular spot. That was Munster Terrace. There's plenty of others named, I know. You could see them put up there, Piccadilly Circus and things like that.
On signs. There were signs.
Oh, yeah, just the Joker used to put them up.
So during the day, it was a lot of waiting then. You wouldn't be firing your machine gun.
Oh, no, you're waiting, yeah. You may go through the day and not fire it at all. had no good wasting on it, nothing hitting ground.
What about at night? What would you do at night?
The same thing very well happened then. If you heard, now we used to get told now, we were in the front line with our machine gun. Now, the word come round between 1 and 2, or 1 and 12, we say, 12 and 1 rather, time, don't fire within 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock. Now, if you can understand, you're facing their line like that. 10 o'clock here is over on your left. 2 o'clock is over there.
So 12 o'clock was straight in front of you?
Straight o'clock, yeah. Between those two areas, don't fire between 12 o'clock and 1 o'clock. And they say the Gurkhas, or whatever there, or somebody else, is out on a recce patrol. And they want to find out what they can, or bring a prisoner in. So you're not to fire on them. And I remember, now this is the honest truth, there's no blarney about this one. We had this order one night, and the Gurkhas were very, very partial to the English soldiers. And this thing was in operation this particular night, and I was on the gun. And I never heard or saw anything until I heard a voice say, "All right, Johnny, all right, Johnny." That was him talking to me. He was just coming in. He'd been out there. "All right, come in." He come in over the parapet with the Turk's head in his hand. Now, that wants believing, doesn't it? Yeah, he'd been over there, those cookeries they wear. I had one here at home. He'd been over there, and he'd cut Turk's head off, and he brought it with him to show what he'd done. He came over there and said, "All right, Johnny." And he held the head up with the hair.
Did you ever go into no man's land on a raid or a patrol?
No, we were a covering party most of the time.
When you were a covering party, would you stay in your trench?
Oh, yes.
You wouldn't go forward?
No, you'd have your gun laid on certain areas and cover that area. Then others further along, they'd have cover and overlapping area for you. But another instance now in the summertime, when I say they put water points in at one place, our guns crew, there were 6 of us, we were always, as I say, during the afternoon or morning, there's really nothing to do. There's no actual conflict. And we take it in turns to go down and get the water. Well, it happened to be my turn this particular day. So the number 2, he sat up near the gun, as I would have done. And number 3 alongside me, and the others, there were 3 on that side and 3 on this side. And the paradox, I think. Paradox, not dox. And so I went down for this water, and I came back with 2 tins on, and I couldn't see anybody about much. I said, "What's happened?" Well, he said, somebody else told me they'd opened up with the artillery. They'd fired the first one dropped in our reserve trench, which was behind our line, our front line. The next one in between the 2 lines, and the 3rd one right alongside of our gun. It killed the number 1, who was actually my number 2. It killed him straight. He got cut nearly in half, they said. This chap got hit, and the 3 along there. They all got hit, splinters, not too badly, but... or some worse than others, and I just walked in with the water. So if it hadn't been for that, I'd have been sitting there alongside the gun. It was just a matter of one of those bits of luck again.
Did that not upset you, losing your crew like that?
Oh, yes. Well, you wonder who you're going to get, more or less, more than anything. You were very sorry about them, because there's some likeable chaps among them all. I think the main thing is... who are you going to get with you? Are they going to be all right?
And were they? Did you get
it? Oh, yeah, most of the people all came up to scratch. It's surprising what you can do.
How did you get on with the men generally, your fellow other ranks, privates, or able seamen?
Oh, well, on the whole, I think we got on very well. And Some you like better than others, of course. It's the same as any congregation of men. Some you like, some you don't like. But in a case like that, you've all got to work together. You were there for the same, all there for the same job.
Did he have a special friend? You know,
well, that number two who got killed on that gun.
Do you remember his name?
Twycross. And he was, I don't know where he came from. He came from Scotland. But I didn't know his address or anything at all. And I always remember when we getting in the depot, we got in the line and going getting in our numbers. I know I was, my number was 17513. Now, he was either 17512 or 17514. He was one either side of me, which I don't know which now. And when we toured Scotland a little while back with the daughter and that, I was automatically looking every place we went to and listening to hear if I could anything about the name of Twycross. I never heard from him, or I never wrote to his people. I didn't know their address. I can't tell you the place he came from, except that it was Scotland. But he's a very, very nice chap. Jock, of course, that's all I knew him by.
So, would, with a special friend, he'd be the one you'd share your food with, would he? Or?
Oh, yes. Yes, and we seemed to get along together very well.
What about the NCOs? How did you get on with them in the trenches?
Very well, really. Except, no, I'm not going to say that. Except one, I'm not saying in the against, I'm not going to tell his name. Now, I told you we have, in a gun, we have a split barrel at times. That's through overheating, and the barrel splits. Well, this NCO, he was there was this company sergeant major. He used to come round every so often, walk round the trenches, see if things were all right. And that particular morning, our gun was out of action because of the split barrel we had. We'd just been firing and it split. So I got it down, I'd got it opened up, the machine gun. And he came round and he said, "Why isn't his gun not firing? Why isn't it in action?" I said, "Well, we've got a split barrel, just waiting for it to cool off." Because you could, they were red hot pretty well, you see. Waiting for it to cool off to change it. "Oh, it's cool enough now," he said, and he put his hand in, like that, so he'd pulled out. It stuck to his hand. And off he went. He said, "We never saw him again." Good at doing, really. As a matter of fact, in that book,
it's a pretty stupid thing to do, though.
Of course it was. He thought he was going to show us up, you see. "Oh, it's all right now." He gets his hand in and gets the barrel stuck to his hand.
He's lucky he didn't get accused of self-inflicted wound, really.
Yeah.
But the others were all right. The others were pleasanter than
that. He was all right, apart from that particular day. And I think perhaps I made a lot of it because I was pleased to be able to take a rise out of
them. Did they relax discipline a bit in the line? Was discipline more relaxed in the line than it had been?
Well, no, in some ways, of course it was, but in other ways, it was not relaxed. It was still kept up to scratch.
What about the officers? Did you see much of those?
Well, they visit every so often, pretty periodically.
Did they not live in the front line with you then?
They usually had a dugout there, same as we did. We used to dig in underneath the parapet and scoop out a...
But would they actually live in the front line? Were they there with you?
Oh, yes. Yes, they took their share of it. Well, you know, with us there...
They were, were they good officers?
Well, of course, I really didn't have a lot of experience, but... they seem to be, speaking as I found them, for what that's worth.
Were they popular?
Well, some more than others, same as everybody else, you'll get it.
Now, did you get, when you were in reserve, how did life differ then?
Well, then you were called up to to do all the feet, all fatigues that were going.
What sort of things was
that? Well, part of you might have been taken down to the beach to carry up stuff from the big dump down there, you see. Rations and ammunition and all that business, see. And then later on, as they got to know, they got a bit of water in hand, and you could have a quick wash and a change of clothing down there, you see. Because you were, as you went up the line, in the first day, they don't know what the conditions were, so you were like that for the time you were up there, 7, 8, 10 days or whatever it was. You walked through the communication trench, ankle deep in mud and slush. Well, that's how you were when you came out 10 days afterwards. Mind you, the putties, we wore putties then, not gaiters, and they were a godsend. They kept all the bottom of your trousers dry. You wouldn't think so, just winding the old putty round and round. You ever seen them? And then, surprisingly, they kept your legs dry.
Would you get a chance to get a bit of sea bathing while you're in reserve?
Not in the, no, because it meant quite a distance away then. But the, as I say, some did, some units who happened to be, that was their section to look after.
But you didn't?
No.
You never had a...
No.
Did you get letters and parcels? You mentioned briefly you did.
Yes, I used to get always from my mother. She was very, very good. It was a picture paper, Sunday paper, you know, Sunday pictorial or something, I can't forget now, and a packet of cigarettes, and a letter, of course, with it.
What would she write about?
Well, how things were going, what my brothers were doing, why they'd done it, and things like that.
Were the letters very important to you?
What?
Were the letters important to you?
Oh, yes, they were. Yeah, you'd look forward to them, and you could see the disappointment on people's faces when you came along with a bag full and there wasn't anything for them.
Did anyone else write to you?
No, it was only my mother. It was may have been the boy put on the end of her letter, put a few lines on the end of her letter.
What about...
My brothers.
What about were you writing to them? What would you write about?
Well, it was all censored, of course, so you were limited to what you could write. You had a postcard with things printed on it. I'm quite well, seeing across the other road. I'm not well. And, you couldn't really say, hope to be home soon, and anything like that, really. Or you could say, well, I'm all right. Hope you're keeping well, and that's about it.
Now, you'd still be under shell fire when you're in the reserve lines.
Oh, yes.
Did being under shell fire, or the risk of shell fire, continually, did it upset you at all, or did it make you edgy?
No, not then, but I can come to that again later, if you want it.
Okay. Now, during the summer, there were a series of British attacks, you know.
Yes.
In May, you know, the first, second, third battles of Krithia.
Yeah.
And then again in the August, there was the diversionary attack while they went round to Suvla. Do you remember any of those attacks and what you had to do during them?
No, we were... I can't say that I remember anything distinctly about any of them. It seemed to be one of those things that we'd done every day, you know... We took up our position, we got our gun in position, where the best place we could see, overlooking some place, and make that our target, and, you know, things like that.
So you'd provide covering fire for an attack, would you?
You would do.
You wouldn't have to actually attack yourself?
No, we didn't go over, not with the rifle and bayonet in your hand, because you'd go up afterwards, after the our troops had gone, and then they were set, and then we went over and helped consolidate the land.
So you take the machine gun up to consolidate?
Yes.
But you don't remember anything in particular about any of the attacks or anything that happened in that phase?
I can't say that I do.
What is the next thing you remember then?
The thing I'd always stuck in my mind was, you know, all the we were attached to the naval division. Well, all the divisions, all the battalions were named after Navy admirals. Well, the Collingwood Battalion landed one day. They'd been in training elsewhere, see. They went up the line the next day, and they joined in the attack the third day. They went up 1,000-odd strong, see. And they came back the fourth day with about 300 of them left. Because, well, there were troops on their left and their right that got pushed back. So the Turks could come take over there and enfilade them. Got the Collingwoods in the middle of them like that. And there was, well, as I say, 300 out of that lot came back.
Did you see that happen?
Pardon?
Did you see the Collingwoods get massacred?
No, I saw the result of it when they were coming back. They were moving back.
What state were they in, the 300?
Well, they hadn't been under fire before. They were, you know, shell-shocked and that.
They were in a bad way.
They
but
were
their morale
in a bad,
had gone.
They were in a bad way.
Had their morale actually gone, or was their morale poor?
That's the job to say. With individuals, it would have been it. Some... But it wasn't very pleasant, not even to see them.
Anything else you remember before November? I know that's one thing you remember, the bad weather in November, but anything else from the summertime, anything that happened?
No, nothing much. Oh, Asiatic Annie. Do you remember Asiatic? I heard about her. Well, she used to fire from Schenek, across the other side of the Dardanelles. And then we've actually seen the shell of her dropping. You know, you'd, somebody, you know, one coming over, you know, you'd come along the line, somebody, those near the beach could hear it, see? And it's surprising how quickly it got along, further along. And you're know, looking all around, and you could hear this noise, and you could see it. And I suppose, being kind, 8 times out of 10, that never exploded.
What, dud shells?
Dud shells, yeah. But it's frightening all the same for them. Where's it going to drop next?
Right. Anything else?
I don't think so. No.
Right. Now, in November, the weather really did change.
Oh, wicked. Terrific rain like we've been having here. And, well, we got washed out of the trenches. You couldn't... You know, it filled in the trenches that we had to dig in on the parapet, sleeping on top of the parapet. They were the same, Jerry was the same, just the same.
The Turks?
The Turks were just the same, yeah.
Wouldn't that work? You must have been vulnerable to shoot it, you know.
Oh, yeah, but there was nothing done like that. That was there was a truce, more or less. You know, unspoken truce. But I did hear say... It's only hearsay. I haven't any proof at all. There's quite a few of our chaps were drowned in the trenches. You know, they're up on the parapet, then cold with it, and just tumbled off into the trenches and got drowned.
How did you feel with the cold and wet?
I mean, miserable. But again, we survived, and that's all you can say.
Was there any problem with frostbite with some people? In your unit?
No, not... No, it didn't seem to be the frost that way. It was all a wet cold, you know. Winds and the rain, and continuous rain. Of course, once you were wet for forevermore, as you might say.
Did you see the situation... I mean, you were only a private. Did you see the situation at Gallipoli as being tenable? Did you expect evacuation?
No. I couldn't see much end to it because as we were up the front line each time, we were in the foothills of Aki Baba, the hill Aki Baba. The Turks were on the rise, you know, following that, then overlooking us all the time. So I couldn't see us doing much. I don't know that I thought about it a lot.
When did you get your first indication of evacuation might be coming? When did you first...
Oh, but the night it happened.
So you hadn't noticed anything happening before?
No.
In December?
The only thing was the French were evacuated. They were on our right. They were down to the edge of the Dardanelles, their sector of trench. And they went over, went taken off the peninsula on the 1st of January. And we were next to them, and we had to spread ourselves out to cover their ground with this, you know, with less men than what they had in a way. So we had to cover more than twice what we had before. I'm the only one to be here, and not my, you know, just a couple with a machine gun. We spread, had to spread them out, and the next one might be 25 yards away, something like that.
So very weakly held.
Very weak, yes, for until the 8th.
Now, hang on. Is this where you found yourself with a sort of unspoken truce with the Turks, where you were overlooking the valley?
No. No, that was a bit earlier than that.
What happened there then?
Then?
Where was that at?
That was down towards the Dardanelles, but not so far as where the French used to be.
It was in the British section, but not right on the right where the French.
It wasn't right on the right.
And what was this truce? Because it seems.
No, it was only. It wasn't a truce. It was an unspoken truce. We both knew that we could kill each other when we wanted to.
Why was that? Could you just explain
it? Because of the situation, the contours of the ground. See, we were up here on a gully coming down that way. Valley at the bottom and then going up again the other side. So you get on top of that, our trench was halfway down across there. Turks was halfway down. You get on the top of the gully and look down, you can have a clear view of everybody, see? And they knew it was more or less, anybody doing anything. It was just murder, really. It wasn't fighting. And there was no word spoken that it's... But you were told not to fire.
Who by? Your officers?
Yes.
Now, and then from there, you moved along, extended into the French part.
That's right.
Was there any question of a sort of unofficial truce where the French had been?
No, because the ground altered again. No, more or less.
So there was normal firing there?
Oh, yes.
Did you see anybody dressed or pretending to be in French uniforms to try and... Was there any decoy to try and show that the French hadn't evacuated that you remember?
No, I don't remember that.
So, did you know that Suvla and Anzac had been evacuated?
No.
You didn't see any orders or anything?
No. Anything you heard was just word of mouth. Yeah, there are no orders written up anywhere.
So, when did you first... find out about it on the night of the...
On the night, yes. We were...
You didn't see the Turkish attack on the 7th. I think that would be further up the line.
No.
Right.
Earlier in the evening time...
Hadn't you been destroying stores?
Oh, yes. We were told... we were issued with a white band. We've got to tie it around our left arm. Left upper arm. And told to destroy any foodstuff that we weren't going to use ourselves, any guns that we couldn't carry, and ammunition, you know, do away with them. Just a matter of taking the bolt out of there and unscrewing the top bit and throwing that way and the belt the other way. See, they couldn't put them together. They won't fire without... That's where the little pin comes through that fires the cartridge.
What about the food? How did you destroy the food?
Well, we just dug a hole and tipped it in.
And when did you do this? Was that the day of the evacuation?
Yeah, the day, or the early evening part of that same day.